suppose I have a story to tell you. I don't think anybody heard the story. It only happened 2 weeks ago. I was getting a quirky, something quirky with my desktop computer. Something wasn't quite right. It was some errors that don't normally happen. And I suddenly felt like maybe this is time to do a little extra backup, just in case. I went and ordered from an online store that I trust a 500 gigabyte backup drive. That came very quickly. I backed up the entire computer onto it, and the next day, the computer was gone. I mean, and the tech support said you have to replace the whole drive. They couldn't, there's no data recovery that can happen, but I had it all backed up on this extra drive.
Wow.
So then, I took the backup drive, and I plugged it into another computer. There's only three computers on the network. It's a very small office. I plugged it into this other computer, and I then dumped the data back on the other computer to be a new server. It was the server that had crashed. I dumped the data on the new server, and I was using the backup drive, and then the backup drive went kaput.
No.
And tech support for the backup drive, that company told me there's no saving your drive. You have to either reformat it or replace it. They couldn't, unless you're going to pay $1,000 to get the data recovered. But I had it. I figured the only thing I lost the most recent update of the Mill Valley mailing list, but that's recoverable because I have a hard copy. And I lost about 2 hours of work I put into a new book I'm writing. Okay, so I lost two. I have the previous edition, but I hadn't backed up the last 2 hours. So that's, as far as I know, that's about all that I lost.
And I have a data recovery service if you want to send that drive over.
I appreciate it.
That's very good.
And they're less than $1,000?
I don't know about that. Yeah. Depends on how bad.
It's bad. Evidently, that what the data recovery people told me is that something is wrong with my FAT.
Which is?
Your what?
Capital F-A-T. Well, it turns out that stands for File Allocation Table. But I was wondering, is there a hidden message here that I should be maybe losing a little weight? I'm asking, it sounds cute, I'm making a joke, but what I'm asking you is, what is the message? Is there a message? Is there an interpretation? When something like this happens to you, something inconvenient, and perhaps something unpleasant, you get rear-ended, God forbid, or you can't find your favorite screwdriver, God forbid, because you didn't get the chance to build that workbench that you really need in your house, right? When something like this happens to you, is your reaction bad luck? I had a bad day? Or is there more of a message in there? Is there a deeper message in that? And I gave the title tonight From Hangnails to Hurricanes because I wanted to focus us on the range of life experiences. And I'd like you to walk out of here tonight with not only a more clear idea of how to interpret messages in what happens to you, but specifically to apply that wisdom to your relationships and your most significant relationships, so that what happens won't be sort of a daily in and out, but it will actually be something that can be a message driven and help you grow. How's that sound?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good.
So if those of you have pen and paper, you can do this on paper. And if you don't have pen and paper, you can do this in your head. I would like to ask you to start by thinking about a person in your life who you have a relationship with. It can be your most significant relationship. It doesn't have to be. That would be a best if possible. It doesn't really matter. Choose a person who you have a relationship with. And I'd like you to write down or have in mind three of the most irritating things that happen in that relationship. And I chose my words very carefully. I said three of the most irritating things that happen in that relationship. So I don't want necessarily to point fingers and say that person is doing these things or that person is to blame necessarily, but it may be just a difference of personality, it may be simply circumstance. But every relationship has things that are irritating, that they don't have to be terrible, horrible things, but they might be small things. But I'd like to have in mind three irritating things that happen in a relationship. And if you don't feel like you're ready to do this with your own relationship, pick someone, another couple you know. and how they interact with each other, and you know how what your friends say about what their husband or wife does that irritates them because when they're venting a little bit. So maybe you heard something on the radio. Even it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to be personal right now. But I just want to get you thinking about what might be a typical irritating type of habit a person has, or mannerism, or pattern of interaction that we have that irritates me and always bothers me, or irritates them and always bothers them. I want to take some objective looks at these things and to get outside of our own skin. Because when I'm feeling irritated, it's very hard for me to be objective. When I'm feeling irritated, all I'm feeling is irritated. But to be able to use that experience for wisdom requires some objectivity. Okay? So take a minute, even less than a minute, a few seconds. Just think and try to come up with three irritations that might be typical to a relationship. And by expanding it and allowing you to think about another couple, that will allow you to share. And no one knows if you're talking about your own relationship or someone else's anyway. Because we don't really need this to be personal. This is not a counseling session. This is the time to discuss and try to analyze. Okay? Someone want to share one that you thought of? Jamie?
My daughter was sick, and I told my mom, and I could have predicted that she would have said, well, if you would have taken her to the doctor when you first started, but I'm not a person who jumps to take the kids to the doctor, and she always thinks the minute anything happens, and, you know, automatically it's my fault, and, you know, if I would have taken her to the doctor sooner, but yet I tell her. You know, yet I tell her. I don't know how this cycle always goes about. I say, oh, she's really sick. Maybe, you know, and she's like, well, you should have taken her at the first time. And I know I shouldn't even tell her until she's better. But it happens. So that I'm classified as irritating. Because I fall into it, too. She always has the same response, but I hand it to her on a silver platter. Every time.
Anyone else?
Christopher snores.
You're
doing really well.
I have a solution for that.
Earplugs.
No, I'm serious.
Okay, we'll talk later.
If you want to share, we could try to do it without a personal name, and that way we'll.
Someone I know snores.
In bed at night.
Let's say a husband snoring. Let's say a wife snoring. Okay. Happens
too. My mother snores too.
Snoring. Okay, that's
snoring.
But that's actually a good example. I'm glad you brought both those examples. And one example is Jamie's example is something someone's saying, and therefore has a lot of control over, even though maybe a habit. And your example is something someone's doing while unconscious, and presumably has less control over, and perhaps zero. Although yes, there's treatments, etc., but that's still unconscious action, totally unintended. Yeah? Any other examples?
My mom, no matter, I grew up in Montana, and I moved back, and my mother is always telling me which direction to go. And if I make, it's like I have to go left.
Isn't that part of the genealogy?
But come on, what's even funnier is that my son, I do it to my son. Ooh. And when he caught my mother doing it to me, he was sitting in the back seat and he started laughing because it was exactly what I do to him. So it's like the being sick, but I'm seeing it repeated already to my next generation.
Just so you know, we're laughing with you, not at you.
So now we call it a Nana. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's really funny.
Interesting. Yeah. Did you have that?
Yeah. I have a teenage daughter, and no matter what you ask her to do, she will argue first for a very long time. She will do it at the end, and when she say, okay, I did it. Why are you upset about it? I say, okay, you argue with me for an hour to take out garbage. I'm upset about it. So, I mean, at the end, she feels like she did what I asked her, so I should be pleased with her, and she deserves to be praised. And I feel like I spent so much energy.
But teenagers are in a class by themselves.
Yeah,
maybe they should
don't
be outside
count.
Of the discussion. Yeah. Yeah, you are.
We have some friends who will, in our company, they'll change their tone
voice, and if they are a little bit upset at one another, so it's kind of in our group during dinner party, you'll hear the change of tone, and it just
makes everyone uncomfortable.
Yes.
They yell at each other in public?
They're not public, but they will say, they will make remarks at one another, or they will, the woman will maybe say, oh, he didn't start, you know, he should have done this or that. So.
Criticize each other in public.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't acknowledge that what you said was heard, and then you get accused of repeating yourself. You say it over and over again because you don't get an acknowledgement that, yeah, I heard you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about being irritated. It's an example. I can understand why I would get irritated that someone dear to me did something. But why do I get irritated at someone that I would see tomorrow in the next 5 minutes? I don't know who he is. Just irritates me. Like someone cuts you in the freeway. I'm not seeing him. No relationship. If someone in the house does it, I see some reason for that. Why we do it with people that have no consequences in our life, except momentarily, even not even that.
So the bottom line is, I'm glad you asked the question. The bottom line is that what's underlying all of what you're thinking and what people are saying really goes down to the heart of, in according to Jewish thought, Jewish philosophy, why we're here at all. That why we're in this life. Judaism, the way I learned Judaism, is of the opinion that life has purpose and has meaning, and it's not simply a random product of random evolution, but of, you know, species that arrived at human beings and now we're trying to make retroactive sense of our existence. But that it has inherent meaning and we are put here for a determined purpose. And that's actually, this has to be, I think, a starting, for all these things to make sense in a big scale, I shouldn't say it has to, but it's a very helpful as a starting point. So I want to roll backwards and go deeper a little bit and start with that underlying meaning. And then I think that it'll answer your question. And what it will help do is all these things you mentioned, these cycles of parents and children and the physical challenges of someone who has a physical problem that they can't control and arguing and criticism and not listening well, very serious. All these things actually fit in to this beautiful model of why we're here.
They're all a gift.
Why, and in what way are they all a gift? What do you say? Let's go further. Let's go deeper. What's the purpose first?
The opportunity to look at it and look at yourself.
What's the purpose of that?
To improve yourself.
What's the purpose of that?
To evolve.
To what?
Be happy.
Be a great person. To be happy.
What's the definition of happiness? A definition of a great person?
Purpose.
What are we getting at? Where's it supposed to be taking me? It seems like this cycle that goes in, day out. I always get irritated every time someone cuts me off on the road. I don't seem to be getting anywhere. Where am I supposed to be going with this? What is this nice word, happy? What do you mean by that?
To broaden your
transcendental. To transcend one to that more godliness, to that more
connection,
that more spiritual.
To that eighth dimension.
Maybe at peace with yourself.
To live in the present.
Taking pleasure in what we have.
To get beyond our physical needs.
And live to your full potential.
You know, the everything, I love everything you're all saying. Is there a common denominator? There's a lot of live in the present, live for pleasure, live to fullest potential, godliness.
It's the individual.
That's the common denominator? What do you mean, the individual?
The person that God created as reflecting with another person that God created.
Why?
That was 2 lectures ago. I know what you're saying.
I'm not saying, I'm asking.
I am listening to the thought, and I think of the person that we bring in that God has created and how we relate to another presence that God has created.
Yeah.
So like the ultimate soul pleasure, like you said, to get beyond the physical.
the difference between Judaism and other systems, one of the most fundamental differences is many other religions, to reach holiness, to attain holiness or some enlightenment, requires, you know, going to a mountaintop, fasting, negating the physical. And Judaism is opposed to that. Judaism says our definition of holiness and enlightenment is with the physical, through the physical, elevating the physical. And all these things that are part of our real daily existence, which you could say are mundane, I want to go to the temple or the synagogue or the mountaintop and just transcend them. This is the key to be able to transcend via the snoring, via the hangnail, via the hurricane. Somehow that's got to be part of, otherwise, it's what we would call escapism. So how do you do that? And what is the ultimate purpose?
You're kind of referring to somewhat a lot of what Eastern religion's about in terms of like being a monk or being like more solitude to get to the holiness. What I hear you saying is Judaism is different than that. That's what differentiates, say, Buddhism or the Eastern religions and Judaism.
And also different from mystical Christianity, which is about fasting and asceticism and celibacy in the Catholic tradition, that denying, in a sense, the physical, in order to reach something spiritual. Yeah? In other words, the Jewish, you can use in colloquial terms, the Jewish idea of heaven, so if we want to use the word heaven, is you can experience it now here. You build it here. It's not something you go to that's waiting for you. Once a person dies, they enter a place that's waiting for them called heaven. Heaven is what you create. You will experience something beyond death, but it is what you've created by how you use the physical in this world. It's a sort of a transcendent experience of the physical world that you used in this lifetime. That's a little bit advanced. I want to still focus a little bit on this fundamental question, why we're here. I don't think we've quite articulated that clearly. Yeah, and this is a big problem in the world today because we have this old Michelangelo factor, which I've talked to many times. Remember my whole talk about the Michelangelo factor? Michelangelo and Western art and Western tradition have given us a skewed, corrupted, cartoonish image of what we call God. And therefore the word God is like almost taboo among people who are spiritual seekers because it's equated for a lot of people with something that they're not interested in. So I hesitate to use the word at all unless I know for sure we're on the same page. But what I'm talking about is, yes, before the Big Bang, we assumed that there was something that made the Big Bang happen. And that's something, if you want to label it God, fine, label it God. The all I know about it, I don't know anything about it except for what it isn't. All I know about this pre-Big Bang thing is that it's not finite. Because finite is what we have after the Big Bang. So anything before that is infinite, right? That's all I know about it, not finite. But other than the fact that it is a creator that created everything. But here's the rub. Here's the guy, the coal. And Stuart, I think, was alluding to, maybe Lily as well. By definition, if what created you and me is infinite, by definition, what does that creator need from us?
Enough.
Oh. Absolutely nothing, right? Because if it needs something, need means lacking, and lacking means finite, right? Then why create us?
Well, according to your book, to receive.
Create us to do what?
Receive.
Receive what?
The infinite.
Why do that?
Well,
why would an infinite... Put yourself in God's shoes for a second to speak, okay? There's a wonderful...
Is there a sequel to your book? Because I don't think you answered that question.
Which question?
So why?
There's a wonderful little book. If you like, I'll send you the link to it. It's called If You Were God. And it asks you... It's a little pamphlet almost. It asks you to imagine... By Rabbi Arya Kaplan. He asks you to imagine that you're God... Okay, I'm asking you, put yourself in God's shoes, okay? As a creator of a universe, okay? What's the purpose? Think about it. You're absolutely infinite. You have nothing lacking. What is the purpose?
So what was joy recognized? Philippians 6:7, Paul was.
That could be a reason. Recognition.
Pleasure.
To witness joy.
Share the wealth.
It's kind of like your what you experience with your children. You kind of, you almost, I mean, if you get to the point where you're almost egoless, meaning you'd actually walk through ground glass for their sake, then you just to see them do everything from the positive to the negative, you just are filled with such awe that it's just awesome. And you just want them to keep on experiencing everything, even the bad things, because you know in the end somehow it'll make them.
I'm glad so glad you used that analogy, because that's I think very powerful. The idea of a parent, a relationship between a parent and a child. What does a parent want from the child? They want to get to the child. They want the child to be dependent on them forever?
No.
No. What do they want from the child?
To
become independent. What's the ideal then? The child grows up and says, Mom and Dad, thank you very much. It's been great. Appreciate it. Have a great life and never see them again?
No.
That would be independent, wouldn't it?
Right.
That's not what parents want either, is it?
No.
What kind of independence do we want from our children? We want independence, but not...
We don't want independence. We want self-sufficiency. And
a relationship.
Share.
You want a relationship. You want connection.
We still want the relationship.
Right.
That is...
Jewish mate. Don't get
me. But see, all that's really lacking from the infinite... There's nothing lacking by definition except for that giving. What the Kabbalists tell us is that the whole purpose of this existence, of this universe, the Big Bang for the last 13 billion years till today, is so that that infinite being, whatever it is, has someone to give to, can actually give to somebody. That's the only, I don't know why this God needs to give, that's like beyond me, but that's the function that we're here for, as Lily said, to be able to receive. But what's the greatest thing we can get from an infinite giver? What's the most amount of goodness we can get?
Relationship.
Why? Why is a relationship the greatest thing we can get?
Because it's a giving thing.
What do you mean?
Because it's a relationship.
Why is that the ultimate?
Giving and receiving.
Why is that the ultimate?
Because it connects us with that.
It connects us with back with this with the source, by which by definition is infinite. So you can't get greater than infinite, right? I hope everybody sees it. For some people, you've discussed this with me for many years, and it's not a new idea, but it's worth revisiting. But now, listen to this thought. This is the new thought for you for tonight. Based on, if you take that as an assumption, whether or not you buy into it or not, I don't care. You could totally think that this rabbi's totally off his rocker. I don't buy this at all. That's fine. Just take that as for sake of discussion for a second, and just see the beauty of this model. Because if that's true, that this entire universe is created in order for us to be able to have an infinite relationship, right? What that means, implies, if the Creator is truly infinite, is that every detail of the world is there for that purpose. Every single detail, from your hangnail to your hurricane, is there for that purpose. And to teach me how to reach that total, as Lily was saying, transcendence. That's what we mean by transcendence, is to have that relationship. Every detail. And in fact, what the mystics say is that it's built so much into, we are the only creatures in the universe, we believe. We don't know, but we believe we're the only creatures in the universe who have the kind of free will that we have. If there's some others in some other galaxy, it doesn't really bother me, it doesn't really matter, but the point is we're the only ones that we know about, at least on this planet. What do we do with our free will? We have the ability to make choices. And our choices have a parallel effect. It affects our karma in this world and affects what happens, so to speak, in the transcendent world. We have this God-given ability that whatever we choose, to choose good or evil, it creates a chain effect throughout, not just across horizontally with karma, but transcendentally. In other words, the way we act affects the way God acts. Not just to us, but to the whole world. So if we want a world to be infused with godliness, we have to ourselves take upon ourselves the godliness. God will then create more godliness in the world. It's a direct effect, not just horizontally through my life, but also up and down vertically. I'm using funny metaphors to get to a point. The point is this. If the goal is the relationship with God, with the transcendent, with the infinite, and we're mirroring that on this world, then, as Carol said, parent to child, that's one mirror. You know what another mirror is? Man to woman, woman to man. And that idea of man to woman, woman to man, the idea that that's where we traditionally create the absolute most intimacy in our relationships, well, many, many relationships, but traditionally the most intimate relationships is between one single man, hopefully, and one single woman, right, at any given time. Suppose they could have multiple intimate relationships, but let's just talk about one at a time, right? That itself is a microcosm of a relationship between the transcendent creator and all of humanity. So that if we can fix that relationship, we can effectively fix the relationship between of all of humanity to our source. And we can learn lessons about how, from one to the other, how God relates to people, we can learn about how man relates to woman, and vice versa. So, for example, I spoke about this about a year ago, but it bears repeating, about men and women. You know, these things that you're telling me about, these cycles and the physical and the arguing and the so on. I was just on the phone with this couple in another state on the way here who I thought they were about to kill each other. I mean, they were really, I didn't know, it's very hard on the phone, especially I'm navigating the streets of San Francisco. And my Bluetooth thing has the batteries run out. And my GPS is telling me turn right, turn left, and I've got this. Okay. It was very challenging. But I was thinking, if they only realized that they were made for each other. Literally. This is the Jewish approach to it. That this person in your life is in your life because he or she is supposed to be in your life. Does that mean that divorces should never happen? No. That sometimes divorces have to happen. But as long as that person's in your life right now, that's how it's supposed to be right now. And you have to deal with it. Now, I'm not talking about an abusive situation. If there's actual abuse, that's a different story, and I'm just not going to accept that from this entire discussion right now. That doesn't belong here. I'm talking about a situation that's not abuse, not actually physically or emotionally abusive, but it's just challenging, okay, for the sake of discussion. What I'm telling you is that if we can learn about men and women relating to each other, we can learn about deep and powerful transcendence as well. And what do we know about men and women? What's the most fundamental thing we know about men and women?
They're different.
They're different, right? How different are they?
Very.
They're so different, right? What is, you know, now, these are stereotypes, admittedly, but it's not an accident that many traditions have tapped into this. You know the yin-yang? If you looked at chapter 7, chapter 8 of my book, I have the actual Chinese yin-yang in there. If you haven't got a copy, I think we have a copy for you tonight before you go. The yin-yang, the Chinese yin-yang, the black and the white, and they're moving, and the black has a white dot in it, and the white has a black dot in it, because no man is all male, and no woman's all female. We're all some balance of this. And I taught this to this one couple at one time, and the woman said, you know, in my relationship, I'm the male. That's okay. It's not a bad thing. You have to know yourself and know your significant other. This is just a stereotype to help us understand differences. It doesn't mean it applies exactly this way to everybody. That's okay. But understand the model, and then you can apply it to your own situation. Maleness and femaleness have definitions. And again, this may apply different to you and your situation, but maleness is, by definition, unbridled energy. Constantly seeking newness. Constantly seeking creativity. And not having much focus. That's pure maleness. Femaleness, by definition, is the ability to take that energy and build it into something. And to focus it and concentrate and actually do something with it. Right? A good analogy is an architect creating a blueprint and a builder building a house. Who's more important? The architect or the builder? The architect. The idea of coming up with a blueprint, that's a very, quote-unquote, male thing to do. And the building of the house, that's, quote-unquote, a very female thing to do.
Rabbi Seinfeld, why does that seem backwards to me?
don't know. Maybe because in our society, most of the construction workers are male. I don't know. But that's think about it in terms of biology. In the most creative act people can do, which is creating a new human being, a man's contribution to that is almost purely information, right? It's an infinitesimally small, and he has almost infinite potential for newness in that direction. Whereas the female contribution is typically one at a time, and she takes his information, his creative potential, and she builds something with it. You see this biologically. And in Jewish thought, it's no accident that the biology and the psychology tend to be parallel here. Right? This is really psychology.
I'm just looking at the workforce. I'm looking at my own personal relationship. I'm looking at what I understand about society. And it's the men that are the builders. Not always. Don't get me wrong here. But typically it's the females that are the more the creative, the decorators, the colors, I think.
On the contrary, even if what you were saying is true, I'm not sure it is, but even if it's true, what you used an example of decorators. Decorating what?
The home that was built by...
It doesn't matter who built it.
They're creating a home.
It's the living in it that's the matter. It's how we're going to use the home, right? I mean, that's an example. By the way, Jewish thought says if you're married and you're a man and your wife says, I want to rearrange the furniture for the 40,000th time, your reaction should be, sounds great. That you should totally respect that is a need of hers, and that's her business to say that if she wants to. Because typically, not always, but typically, it's more important to a woman than it is to a man in the bottom line. Now, that's not always the case, and sometimes it's very important to the man, that has to be discussed, but I'm giving you what I found is very, very typical. And I was with this couple one time where she was very upset because every time she wanted to do something in the house, he nixed the idea.
Basically, what you're saying is that male is in strategy, woman is an execution, tactical execution.
And, you know, this, in these stereotypes, yes.
I'm not agreeing.
But no, but many people are different blends of these. No one is all male, no one is all female. People have lots of... No, that's not true. I didn't say strategy. I think to be...
But it sounds like it, because you said that male is like an idea, and woman is a builder, and a tactical...
I didn't say woman, femaleness. That's different than saying a woman. Everybody is a blend of these two, of the yin and yang. When you are feeling when you're coming up with new ideas, that's your maleness part of you, and when you're actually doing something with that flying, that's your females. We all are a blend of these. I'm labeling these two sides of creativity. Both are important to creativity. You have to have the idea, and then you have to have the execution. And they're both important. We all have both of them. But I'm labeling them so you understand the different energies. Men tend to be more male, women tend to be more female, but no one is 100% one or the other. We all have used both. I hope you use both in your life. I hope you have both energies in you. I've never met anybody who is 100% one or 100% the other. Most people are somewhere, you know, in the, like the yin-yang symbol shows, and they're also changing. No one stays in one way. You might be one way, one balance at this moment, and 10 minutes later you're a different balance.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, dominated factor, for you say, you know, it's like, in maleness, dominated factor is a vision and, like, strategy.
It seems to be for most men.
Can you relate building relationships? Because that's why I say the woman does much better than men. She builds relationships. Men comes with ideas. Talk to this guy, talk to this guy. But if you want to build real relationship, there's no one better than a woman to do it. And he's building something. It doesn't have to be mortar and bricks or anything like that.
If we have time, we'll speak about it later. That's an important topic, but it's a little bit beyond where we're at right now.
It's okay.
Here's the key to understand, though, Benny, before we can get to that, a prerequisite idea to understand, is that this woman in your life, or this man in your life, and you have to apply this to each different relationship, but take one at a time, is here for a reason. And the reason stays the same no matter what person it is. And that reason is to help you get towards that godliness. So, for example, I don't really want to pick on anybody in particular, but when you see, for example, I'll pick Jamie's example of this cycle of, you know, always going through this, right? There's something that you're meant to learn from that. And what you're meant to learn from that may be different than if I was experiencing what I'd meant to learn. Maybe what you're meant to learn from that is to become more patient. Maybe it's that simply all that you need to learn. And once you become more patient, how do you know you've passed the test? You've learned that lesson? How would Jamie, everyone, let's take Jamie's example.
In one ear, out the other, which is what I do with my life.
Right. Or yeah. I was thinking maybe free will. Maybe I should apply more free will, what you were saying. And, but it's a hard one. Do I just not bring it up to her? But then you fly.
Whatever it is you're supposed to do, how does Jamie going to know when she's achieved and passed that test and beyond? Well, she doesn't get irritated anymore. As long as you're being irritated, it's like a wound in the skin. It's a message. Something needs to be dealt with here. If you're not feeling the irritation more, it means you've dealt with it successfully. How do you deal with that? I can't tell you. You have to figure that out. It may be having to discuss with her. Maybe having to change your pattern of your speech. Maybe you're just, like Lewis said, just letting it go without letting it irritate you. That's going to be different for each person. And that's your own need to fix that. But now I want to focus on the male-female issue here, on this intense, intimate relationship, okay? The thing, and this may touch on your question about relationships, but it's a little bit different. Here's something I think is true, and more often than the simple stereotype that I gave you, and that is this, and this relates to you. Women tend to express and want to have their intimacy founded on communication. Women tend to need verbal and also nonverbal communication in the expression and the building of that relationship. Men tend to use more physical expressions of that love and intimacy. And it's because of that that difference causes a lot of pain in relationships. Whereas a woman feels like he's not talking to me right or listening to me right, and therefore I'm not, he can't warm me up intimately. He can't expect me just to jump into bed with him. I need discussion. I need to feel that warmth and that verbally. Whereas he is saying, she's not interested physically in me anymore except for once a month. And she doesn't realize that that's how I express my love. She thinks he's just, all he can think about is one thing. He can only think about himself and his body, and that's not what he's thinking. That's how men express themselves intimately, is physically. And men and women don't see this in each other. And if you can appreciate that about the significant other in this intimate relationship, and realize this is what this person needs in order to feel fulfilled intimately, and I want my spouse or my significant other to feel fulfilled intimately, then we'll start trying to give that person more of what he or she needs. So if I'm a man, that means taking more time to communicate verbally, listening better, saying I love you more, writing love letters, etc. All the things that I'm feeling, but I don't normally express myself that way, but that's what she needs to hear, the way she needs to hear from me, because that's the kind of person she is. And whereas she needs to realize when he wants to jump into bed, it's not jumping into bed for him. He wants physical intimacy because that's the way he expresses love. That's the way men express and feel love differently. And it's not about the purely physicality for them. It's about intimacy.
So how does this relate to Judaism? Sounds like clinical psychology that everyone in Ironson believes in. What's the Jewish connection?
I've never studied clinical psychology. No, I mean, I know nothing about it.
But must be some Jewish connection there. Otherwise, you wouldn't be telling us that.
First of all, this is everything I'm saying to you comes from my study of Judaism. So that's where it comes from.
I'm looking for the Jewish connection.
That is Judaism. You're saying psychology came up with the same conclusions?
No, I just said I've read it in so many places. But to me, it's something that... There must be something unique about us being...
Now,
trying to find some spiritual connection with the Almighty.
Not
as a Christian, not as a Buddhist, but as a Jew.
What was my preface? I told you that what we do in this world is a microcosm or an analogy for what?
Infinite.
for the relationship, right? It's all about this relationship. So the metaphor is, it's only a metaphor, folks, but take it at face value. God as male, and this is why God is referred to in the Torah, usually, not always, but usually as male, because of the yin-yang. God is the yang, the male. Humanity, we are the female. What is this telling us? What is this tell? What does our human relationships tell us about how humanity can relate to God? God is the male is trying to relate and to give. Remember, the female biologically is a recipient, right? The male is the giver, the female is the recipient. Is that true biologically?
Yeah.
Are we on the same page? I don't need to spell everything out in total detail. God being the analogy for the male, the giver. We being the recipient. But man can't give to his wife intimately if she's not interested. She has to want that relationship. She has to let him have that relationship. She has to enable that relationship. So that's the key. The power, the woman has this amazing power to enable the relationship or not enable the relationship. The man has the responsibility to give her what she needs too. It's a two-way street. But she has this power because he can't express himself fully unless it's physically. He can't, as no matter how many times your man tells you, I love you, he's not fully able to feel like you're intimate unless you're intimate. And therefore, you, if you're a woman, have this power, this uncanny power to enable or not enable the relationship. If, assuming he's done what he needs to do. But understand where he's coming from. And then we also have this power as people, as humanity, with God. God is, this is a metaphor, but God is, so to speak, just waiting for us to say, yes, God, we want the relationship. People say to me sometimes, how come there's no miracles anymore? If God would just show me a miracle. You know, back in the Bible days, they got seas split, and dead people come back to life, and people walking on water. You know, they had it easy. If we would just have a few miracles, it'd be a lot easier to be a spiritually connected person, right? That's your fault, according to my analogy, according to this model. It's our fault, because we're not asking for it. We're not seeking that relationship. God's just waiting, so to speak, for us to ask for the relationship. And we're not asking for it, so he's not giving it. We're not making ourselves into recipients, willing recipients. You know, a man cannot, in Jewish thought, rightfully, in a holy, healthy way, force himself on his wife. It's evil. She has to want the intimacy. If she doesn't want it and invite it, it's not going to be that intimacy from his perspective. No matter how loving he can speak to her, there's something lacking if she doesn't invite him into her life in the most intimate way. That's her power. And many women say, I'm just not interested that as much as he is. Well, you're not thinking about where he's coming from. And that's the challenge. It's a challenge because it forces you outside of yourself. And ultimately, that's where we're all stuck. Because we're all stuck in our own egos. What I want. What about what I want? People always say. Okay, what about what he wants? What about what she wants? Stop focusing so much on what you want and start focusing on what the other person wants. If we all did that, think about how our lives would be different. If everybody focused on what someone else wanted instead of on ourselves. The magic of the marriage is you start under the chuppah, if you had a chuppah, you start in your marriage, and what are you thinking about when you're standing under the chuppah? What's the bride thinking? Or what should she be thinking? That I'm the best thing in the world for him, or he's the best thing in the world for me? What does he want her to be thinking?
He's the best thing in the world for me.
Totally selfish. That's how we should choose our significant other. By being totally selfish. That's what we want the other person to be thinking. That's what we should be thinking ourselves. And somehow, over time, and it might take 20 or 30 years, but over time, there's this magic switch where we suddenly start thinking about the other person instead of ourselves. And what their best needs are, their interest is.
20 years or so?
20 or 30.
20 or 30.
You'll be divorced by then if you wake up long.
Hopefully, that's another topic.
I'm in 5 years and I'm I would have lost it a long time ago.
Well, most divorces happen, you know, in the early years of the marriage, actually.
You know,
if people make it over that 5-year, 3 to 5-year hump, they tend to much more chances of long-term success. But the actual total selflessness, where the person, we're totally focused on the other person. If you're doing this before 20 or 25 years, then you're to be commended. You give yourself a pat on the back, because most couples aren't there so fast. It takes a lot, and even it's slow. It's a slow process. You know, it might be after 10 years, it might be 50-50. Half the time thinking about her, and half the time thinking about myself, my own needs. And eventually you want to get to the point where it's always focusing on the other person. If you're both doing that, of course, you're going to have a golden marriage. But it might take a few years.
There's a book that was written that's called Getting All the Love You Want. And it's this basic concept of people make a mistake by getting divorced. That they pick their mates in order to work out the things they need to work out. And they need to stay with it for the long run, because in the end, they do work it out. And that's why they pick the person to begin with.
And so what you need to do, based on what you're saying, is think. Now, go back to the three, I asked you to think of three irritations, and put those back in your mind for a second. Those three irritations are there, and if you want to talk to me about this personally, I'll give you my cell phone number. Those three irritations are there, I guarantee you, because there's something you need to fix in yourself. And therefore, every time that person irritates you, know what you can say to yourself, at least whisper to yourself, this is my tikkun. This is my fix. I need this. It's good for me. As much as it bothers me, it's here to make me better. This is why this person's here. And what you'll start doing, what are you going to feel towards that person when they irritate you if you have that in mind?
Gratitude.
Right?
Yeah.
Give me more.
But goes to waste free. We try to adjust as much as possible, and other person doesn't do it or doesn't do as much.
Right.
You would not feel so great.
Allah is asking a very important question. What if in a marriage, let's say, for example, what if in a marriage she is working on herself in this way and he's not? Or vice versa. He's really on this spiritual path and she's not. So I'm going to role play for a second. I'm, you know, studying, coming to Martin and Lily's, and I'm working on this stuff and I'm integrating and I'm meditating on it. My wife isn't. She's not even listening to the tapes and I can't get her to come. Right? And boy, how does that make me feel? Irritated. There's another irritant. It's another thing, right? It's not an automatic judgment. She's a bad person. Ah, this is something for me to work on. And we could talk about ways of helping her maybe get more interested, because that is a valid point. But it shouldn't be a block to me to growing myself. It should, in fact, it might actually help me. And it could be that that's what I need to get over that hurdle too before she's getting interested. Maybe she's just, and this has happened before, people have told me this. A woman has told me, I was waiting to see how serious my husband really was about this Jewish thing before I got involved. And it wasn't until I saw he was totally serious that I decided to put my foot in the water. That's happened. Or a guy was studying with me for a couple of years, and his wife, zero interest in anything Jewish, anything spiritual. And then she saw he was really committed. It wasn't because he'd done a lot of dabbling, a lot of things. So she thought maybe this is just another kind of trend or fad he was getting. When she saw that it was permanent for him, so then she said, okay, maybe I'll get it. So you have to be patient sometimes. You know, don't. Each person needs their own, but that may be exactly what the test is. It was just you being patient with that other person. You hear that?
Well, having what you're making me think of is a lot of my friends who did divorce went into the marriage thinking that they could change the irritant.
Right.
Let me fix that.
Yeah.
And then they would figure that they met their perfect match. Well, you can't go into a relationship thinking that the person is going to change, because those are the things that brought you to them in the first place. And if you accept the person as they are, then your marriage has a better chance of surviving, rather than thinking that they're going to change to be
Well, there are ways. There are ways that a woman can get her husband to change, but they're indirect, and that's for women only. I don't talk about them when men are around. I'm serious. You're absolutely right. You can't send the message, husband of mine, you are a project, and I'm going to fix you. That's not going to work. There are indirect ways of making it happen, you know. But we'll have to talk about that another time. Take a look.
Once you do achieve that perfection, that everything is working, everything's fine, then you're still missing something. You're missing then it becomes boring. Because if what you said before is that the male always is looking for the newness.
Yeah.
Then there's nothing new anymore.
Well, spice and excitement in a relationship are not a function of irritants. They don't have to be.
Right.
In fact, the spice, if anyone in the room is looking for a relationship, I strongly advise you to pick somebody who has shared interests. If you marry somebody who has, for example, your same passion as you do in skydiving, then you'll go skydiving together and there will be a lot of spice in doing those things together. The spice in a relationship comes from doing things together that you both enjoy doing. The irritants don't have to be the spice. It shouldn't be boring at all. It should be like...
But I know some relationships that aren't that way.
Could be. That's because they don't have much in common.
Right. At the same time, let's say right now I'm interested in biking, but then some months from now I'll be interested in dancing. But the other person is still stuck in the biking and now I'm moving on. So here is the lesson is if I'm not being selfish and I'm just thinking about the other person, then I feel like my wings have been clipped, you know?
There's no magic right answer to the problem. It's a balance. It's a judgment call. But it is possible for two people to grow apart, and therefore don't have much reason to stay married. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there's enough still in common that even though some interests change and you grow, there's enough shared common goals that you can stay together. But truly, if you both totally diverge in your goals and your interests, that would be... a possible reason not to see her.
And maybe you already learned everything you needed to learn in this relationship.
Possibly.
And it's time to move.
I doubt it happens very often, but it's possible. That's not usually why relationships end. It has happened, but it's not very often, in my opinion.
Sometimes I see kids becoming that common interest. And when those kids leave, then they've lost their common.
Very typical. Once the kids... go out of the house. That's the second time. The second most common divorces rate, the lowest, you know, highest divorce rate would be at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The kids in the empty nest. And,
it's going to be a challenge though, because your interests when you have young kids tend to be they're so consuming, and that raising a family is so consuming that those other interests, except for golf, go away. And then when they leave, who are you? And what do you, that could be
but
a challenging
But I love the Jewish wisdom around the marriage couple being the priority relationship. There's so much wisdom about that as being the primary relationship.
I'll answer your question for Lily. An example is, when we focus only on marriages in this discussion, one of the things I'll tell husband and wife is, when you come together at the end of the day, even if you have small children, if you have an infant, it's different, who needs your immediate care. But besides an infant who's crying, needs a diaper change, when you come together at the end of the day, the children should see that everything else stops and you focus on each other.
Mm-hmm.
That, sorry children, you have to wait 10 minutes while I'm speaking to your father, to your mother, and you focus totally on each other for those 10, 15 minutes. That's the message that they get from you, and that's the message you give each other. When, let's say your husband's home and you come home. you've been gone all day and your husband's home with the kids and you come home. You want him to drop everything and focus on you. And you should want that, and that's okay to want that, and he should. And vice versa. Let's say you're at home and he comes home. He wants you to drop everything and focus on him. And that's what you should be. And that tells him and tells you that you're the most important people in the world, and the children are second. And the children see that too. And it's really good for the kids to see that, that that's how you relate to your most intimate person in your life.
What if his mom calls when he talks to you? And he drops everything?
During the first 15 minutes, he shouldn't answer the phone. Tell him I said that. Yeah.
20 minutes you're supposed to get, right?
20 minutes. Okay, I was...
20 minutes. I never forgot that. That was one of the early ones in your old house.
Kept you coming.
It did. I was like, I like this guy.
I'm in the kid raising thing too, but I think that a lot of what I see as a strength in my relationship is that as much as we focus on the kids, it's about how we do it and make the household work together, and how we give and take with each other, because we're the ones that are making it happen, even if a lot of it happens to right now be focused on this child. And so that's our relationship, and that's how we give and take to and with each other. And I mean, we used to bicycle a lot, and so I was really listening, you know, what you said before was very poignant, and he still cycles and I don't, but that's not the point of our relationship. The point of our relationship is that we're a family and we have us. And it doesn't matter if he's bicycling and I'm doing yoga, but when we come together, we still have us. And it's how we do it and make it work together, and how we compromise and how we give and take and how we respect each other, you know.
And the key is always to remember what your spouse or significant other most needs. And the most important thing that he or she needs is you. Because that's supposed to be the center. So think about it. Just think about it for a second. Think about that relationship you have or want to have. Are you giving of yourself? Whether you're a man or a woman, doesn't matter. Are you giving of yourself as much as that your significant other needs? Are you on your best behavior? Are you looking your best? Are you getting enough rest so that you can be there for him or her when, you know, once a day? Those are key issues. And that sends a strong message. Because if you're not, if you're putting other priorities first, as important as they may be, what message are you trying to send? What's the most important thing to you in the world?
It's not important enough.
That's the decision you have to make. Each one of us has to make. And it's a struggle. It's a struggle for me. I know it is. I assume it's a struggle for everybody. I have lots of things. I'm here in California. I'm traveling. I'm doing this and that. Do I take the time to pick up the phone and call my wife and say, hi, just thinking about you? Do I need to tell her that for me? Or do I need to tell her that for her? You know, that's a decision you have to make every single day. It's a struggle every single day how you're going to treat your spouse and how intimate you're going to be. But recognize that the irritants are there to help you get past the problem. And I'd like to leave you. I'm going to be very punctual now. So we've promised people at this new time, and it's about, just about 9 o'clock. I'd like to leave you with this image that I've mentioned maybe a couple of years ago, but it's nice to repeat. And it's about the diamonds. Remember the diamond analogy? What does a diamond look like when it comes out of the ground? You ever seen pictures of a raw diamond? It's like this rock, right? How does that diamond get from that appearance to the way we like to look at diamonds? Shiny.
A lot of polishing.
How do you polish a diamond?
Elbow grease.
Mm-hmm. Elbow grease and what?
Another diamond,
right? You need friction between two diamonds to make a diamond shiny. Do you hear the analogy?
Mm-hmm.
The more shiny the diamond is to start with, the less friction you need to get it complete, right? The rougher it is to start with, the more friction you need. The friction that you feel in your relationship, that's there to make you a shiny diamond. If you choose to let it. Think about it.
I like that analogy because I like that you can choose how shiny a diamond you start with and that you don't have to have the high drama that a lot of people seem to think is passion to have a great relationship.
Yeah, I mean, people come in with baggage from their past, and if they bring that into the relationship, that's like the roughness. Right? There's a good argument for waiting to get married a little later in life. Until you get a little more mature. But even if you didn't, it's not too late. You can still look at, starting today, starting tonight, look at that person in your life, and also your children, and also your mother, and also your neighbors. This is true about every relationship. I'm just focusing on the most intimate, because that's the most intense and should be the most important, but this applies to every relationship. These are all friction to make me a shinier diamond. And when you are the most shiny diamond, you're a person who, as Lily said before, I think nicely, is you're a person who embodies godliness. You're a person who embodies holiness. You're a person who is always patient, who's always kind, giving, loving, all the things we all want to be. You only get there, if you're not there already, 100%, by having these friction moments, these irritating moments, and look at them as something to help you. And therefore, you could ask, what about, I just mentioned the hangnails, what about the hurricanes? Is there anything different between in this model that I'm giving you between a hangnail and a hurricane? Mm-hmm. Can you see how this can apply to no matter what the situation is? I hate to quote this source, but he's not as anti-Semitic as most people think. Nietzsche's quote is, "Whatever doesn't kill me only makes me stronger." Something like that. It's not just makes me stronger, it makes me more beautiful. And we can end up with a totally spiritually transcendent relationship with our spouses, with our children, with our parents, if we choose to look at all of these irritants as a gift that are there to make me a greater person, to make me happier. Mm-hmm. And we can there. And what we'll do is end up fixing not only our own karma, because what's going to happen once Jamie gets over her irritation with that situation? If she's learned that lesson and no longer gets irritated, what's going to happen to that irritant? She's not going to need it anymore. It's going to go away. Do you believe it?
Yeah.
Try it.
So.
We'll
test
it out and see if it works. What's going to happen in a cosmic level if we all fix ourselves and become shiny diamonds and we infuse our lives with transcendence? Then humanity as a whole is going to be infused with this light that we're creating, and there won't be the suffering that we experience in the world that's out there exactly for this reason, because this infinite God is just waiting for us to pick up the phone, so to speak.